The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening along with us on the road to normal. Are we there yet? Normal?
We're supporting troops that we don't even know who they are. We're supporting troops that we don't even know who they are.
We're going to leave that there. I've got a question for Senator.
This is from a guy who gets his foreign policy from the shows.
Normal. We passed that exit a long time ago in the 2016 campaign. But are we lost? No. And that's the theme of this show today. Taking a wrong turn on the way to normal or average does not mean we are lost in any sense. We begin with an anything but average look at the 2016 presidential campaign. Here at The Takeaway, we have been looking for fresh voices to convey just how much the old rules of presidential campaigning have gone up in flames. Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton, the reassuring, familiar names from the days of normal, are having some real trouble with the unusual successes of the Trumps, the Sanders, and the Cruises. Youthful, fresh-looking Marco Rubio has been trying to present himself as a familiar JFK-like alternative and has run into all kinds of trouble battling for third place. Suki Kim is an investigative journalist, a novelist, and a Korean-American. She's best known for infiltrating North Korea as an undercover missionary evangelist and writing the tell-all book, Without You, There Is No Us. But for us and for the New Republic magazine, Suki Kim wandered into the cornfields of Iowa and the lowlands of South Florida for an outsider's look at this campaign, with a particular emphasis on Senator Marco Rubio, trying to appeal to the average Republican and the mainstream American voter and having all kinds of trouble.
He has several worlds. The world I spent time in was his childhood world. In Florida, we all know he's a son of immigrants. I ended up spending time with people he went to high school with. He is very, very, very tight in one part of his personality, still with his friends he went to high school with. Seven men were all his best friends, and they're all Cuban. I went to his high school with one of his buddies from then, and the high school was 88% Hispanic American, and of that, 90% is Cuban. And that's a South Miami high school, which has 2,200 students. So it's a big public school. The principal was Cuban. The vice principal was Cuban. And all those seven friends being Cuban, he comes from in one way, 100% Cuban world, which is pretty remarkable that it's so insular that way. It's a very tight, in a way, endearing world he has. Because how many times you stay in touch with seven best friends from high school and married your high school sweetheart? And he had really designed his career since he was in college. And this is a guy who never excelled academically, barely made it, barely graduated with a minimum GPA from high school. College, he transferred three times from community and state schools with a barely passing grade. So with that, how he positioned himself to where he is thus far. And, you know, they always use the word he's personable, Marco. And that's, you know, I felt like it was a code word for his drive and social skill.
In the land of God down there in South Carolina, is his religious identity coherent? Is it one church? Is it he's the Catholic Cuban or what is it exactly?
Well, you know that Rubio goes to two churches. One thing he's criticized by Republicans, you know, generally is that he flip-flopped on immigration issues, right? And he's transferred colleges three times. With church, with faith, you know, he kept switching. You know, he was Catholic and then he was Mormon and then now he's Catholic and he goes to an evangelical church. I went to his evangelical church, which is called Christ Fellowship. It's, you know, one of the biggest evangelical churches in the country.
I mean, it has like thousands of people in the audience. I mean, it's a huge stadium almost.
Yeah, I mean, it was fascinating because, you know, I'd gone undercover as an evangelical into North Korea, but I'd actually never been to an evangelical church on that scale. And yes, it was like a rock concert. And it was a bit more like self-help stuff than a church that I imagined. But this is where he spends supposedly, you know, every Saturday night going to.
So it's Saturday night with the evangelical, Sunday with
the Catholics.
Catholic,
right.
I see.
So he's both.
What do people in Florida think about that? Do they think he's sincere? Do they think he's ambitious? Do they have passionate feelings about him, supporting him? I mean, does he have a core base of people who think that Rubio is like the thing that's going to help America?
I went to Dominus Park, which is in Little Havana. The older generation who are Cubans are all Republicans in general. They all were Trump followers.
Really?
And then you also talk to Hispanic Americans. Cuban Americans are a very particular breed. They're not really like other immigrant groups. Hispanic Americans don't really speak kindly of Cuban Americans because Cuban Americans have a different set of rules when they come into the country.
Right. They're waved in.
They're waved in.
Yeah.
So I think that whole immigration, when he talks about I'm a son of an immigrant, that he understands immigration, I'm not sure he really does as a Cuban American in a way, when your set of standards are totally different from the rest of immigrants. You know, I'm a Korean immigrant, for example, and it's a very different set of standard for Cubans versus any immigrants or Hispanic Americans. You know,
So when he says the wall, when he talks about a wall, just like Donald Trump talks about a wall, the wall wouldn't apply to Cubans under U.S. law.
Not at all. But, you know, it's interesting because they don't really talk about that. Candidates can't. You know, Florida is a very important, we all know, you know, it's an important place when it comes down to it. So they're not going to alienate Cuban immigrants at all. They don't have to deal with any of this difficulty of what it means to be an illegal immigrant in this country. It's interesting because people think there's Ted Cruz and Rubio as these Hispanic American candidates. Cubans don't seem to embrace Cruz, really. And Hispanic Americans don't necessarily view them as one of theirs either because those are Cubans. And one Rubio follower I spoke to said, you know, there are actually two Hispanic Americans in this among Republican candidates. It's Jeb Bush and Rubio, not Ted Cruz and Rubio. And there's some truth to that, too.
Does Rubio have a plan B if this doesn't work out? I mean, would he be a – do you think based on all of his preparations and his sense of ambition that you get from the people that, you know, you've talked to, would he take some running mate vice presidency? Is it all or nothing?
I think that that's pretty much, you know, vice president role is very possible. They constantly talk about him being so young. I mean, he's only 5 months younger than Ted Cruz, and no one talks about Ted Cruz being so young. So he's really being packaged as that, as the youth, fresh and baby face, all of this stuff. With that, though, you know, because he's the one with a future, I mean, I don't think he's going anywhere.
Suki Kim is an investigative journalist and novelist. She's covering Marco Rubio for the New Republic magazine. Reporter Suki Kim rightly notes that the experience for Cubans seeking to come to America is radically different from other refugees or migrants, which complicates Marco Rubio's attempt to court Latino voters. Cubans, because of the Cold War history between the two nations, can basically show up in the United States to get citizenship, which was the case for Marco Rubio's Cuban family. Yet as Cuban-American Senator Marco Rubio has filed bills restricting entry into the U.S. for other people who claim they are escaping political persecution. In 2015, over 40,000 Cubans entered the U.S. through land ports, according to Pew Research. The preferred route, fly to Ecuador, where visas aren't required, then travel north through Central America, landing at the U.S.-Mexico border. They can also get financial assistance, and after a year, they can apply for a green card. The system has always been something of a sore point among other people of Latin America seeking to work and live in the USA. Joining us to talk about it all is Jeff Thale, the program director at the Washington Office on Latin America. Jeff, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
So, first of all, the spike in entrance from Cuba, what do you think accounts for that?
Well, I think there are really two things going on. On the one side, historically, Cubans traveled by sea. They traveled through the Florida Straits to the U.S. Starting in 2013, the Cuban government let people leave legally without any special requirements, without an exit visa. And so large numbers of people started being able to travel freely, and they started heading, as you mentioned in your intro, to Ecuador and then heading up from there to the U.S. So that's the one side. The other side is, I think, as diplomatic relations between Cuba and the United States move ahead, many people fear that the special status Cubans get will end soon, and it's likely in the next 2 or 3 years that it will. And so they're trying to get here before that, and so we've seen the spike.
Would you say that the attempts by both candidate Cruz and Marco Rubio as Cuban-Americans, having used this pathway to get into the United States and how radically it differs from other pathways to get into the U.S., that it complicates their attempt to speak for other Latinos?
Yes, I think it does. I mean, right now we're in this moment where we've seen this influx of Central American families and children, right? And they are in large numbers fleeing community-level violence as well as lack of opportunity. And we've been holding them at the border. We've been detaining people. We recently have been deporting people who are being returned to violent situations in Central America. And meantime, we're welcoming Cubans with open arms. And I certainly think we ought to treat immigrants, all immigrants, humanely. But there's a pretty stark contrast there in the fact that Senator Rubio and Senator Cruz are on the side of deporting Central Americans and building a wall and restricting border entry when they and many of their kin have taken advantage of a special privilege in the system. Does make it difficult for them to make their case, I think.
And the scene that I described at the U.S.-Mexico border, where the protocol is pretty simple for Cubans, it suggests that there are actual scenes of, you know, huge lines for other Latin American nationals coming into the U.S. that Cubans basically wander to the front of the line and go by families who may be spending days in a line waiting to just even get a no from an official. Is that a realistic scene?
Yeah, well, it's not exactly, you know, physically people are lined up. I mean, border agents interview people as they come in, as they cross the border, either to legal frontier or as they're picked up by the border patrol. Cubans go through a set of questions and then are given a work permit and, you know, as you said, a temporary visa. Other immigrants, including especially Central Americans right now, are questioned and generally detained if they don't have a visa and processed, either released to a family or held prior to getting a deportation hearing. So it's a starkly different situation.
Jeff Thale is program director at the Washington Office on Latin America. He currently directs the Cuba program in that organization. Jeff, thank you so much.
Sure. Happy to be here.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The 140th annual Westminster Dog Show wrapped up last night at Madison Square Garden right here in New York City. Over 3,000 dogs competed, representing all 50 states and 12 foreign countries. But it would be wrong to say that this deeply traditional, wildly ritualized show of shows celebrates average dogs in any way at all. Joining me now is Sarah Montague, co-host of the podcast Dog Story, published dog writer and a celebrated character who is anything but average here at WNYC. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you, John.
It's so great to talk to you. So who was the winner?
The winner was German short-haired pointer CJ. His show name is Vide Mist Garbanita's California Journey.
This particular dog I thought was a great example of the breed and a beautifully free-flowing, moving dog. And so would be able to do exactly what they were bred for. They're sporting dogs, and they have to be able to point and pay attention, and it was pointing and paying attention, and that's what it's all about.
Any idea what this dog looks like?
Yes, yeah. These dogs are extremely elegant. They are considered an all-purpose gun dog. They are lean, have long, shapely muzzles. They have a liver and white speckled coat. They come in various varieties, but this particular dog is liver and white.
And it's all love to Valerie Nunes Atkinson, who was the handler in this particular case.
He's connected to me in an odd way. And I've had a lot of short hairs, but this one, in the dog world, we say you have your heart dog. This is my heart dog.
Aww.
Yeah.
There's a lot of emotion at this very reserved, it seems, Westminster Dog Show. And you hear it in odd places all during the show.
I have to say, reserved is not anything you would have associated with the garden any time in these last 2 days. There are dogs with followings that would rival rock stars, hoots and hollers and murmurs and sighs. It's like a whole collective hug out there.
And was this short hair a favorite, an odd choice, a surprise in any way?
If you were a betting person, you would never, ever want to put odds on this dog show. The favorite going in was, in fact, the German Shepherd dog, Rumor, who is number one dog in the country in 2015. But the German Shorthaired Pointer also had a very distinguished career last year and certainly was clearly a contender for this. His grandmother, Carly, won the show a number of years ago. Mm. And Valerie is, in fact, both the co-owner and the breeder of this dog. So she says that from 6 weeks, she knew he was the one.
Wow. So breeding counts, but also you discovered that diversity counts at this dog show, which is attempting to enlarge and include more individuals and people who are pet owners, because, of course, pet ownership and dog ownership is universal.
Yes, there are actually lots of ways to consider diversity. Of course, the show itself celebrates diversity in dogs. 197 breeds and varieties are celebrated there. But the showing environment has been a little bit less minority representative than perhaps one would like.
And you spoke with Jacqueline Short Wynn, who's an African-American handler, about this very subject.
When it comes to minorities getting into it, I don't think there's any specific way to say why there are fewer of them than there are. All you can do is speculate. I would encourage young minorities to get out and show dogs, do something within the community, whether it's agility, confirmation, do something, because we need more young people in this sport, whether they're minorities or not.
So it's a youth question as well as a minorities question.
Yes, she very properly did not wish to be a poster child for anything, but she said it mostly had to do with things like geography, more opportunities in rural areas where, of course, there are likely to be fewer concentrations. But she really feels outreach to youth will help.
And her dog was?
Her dog was, in fact, a dog that placed behind Rumor in the breed class for German Shepherd dogs. So she was very pleased. It was a young dog.
So she scored very highly.
Indeed.
Indeed. Well, congrats to all of the dog owners and the Westminster Everything But Average. And thanks to Sarah Montague, co-host of the podcast Dog Story. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John. Always
will we see you again next year, I hope?
Absolutely.
What about all those dogs who didn't make the cut? You can send us a photo of your lovable pup that didn't quite make it using hashtag Westminster Reject or tweet us at The Takeaway. You can go to thetakeaway.org/Westminster to see all of our rejects and get a peek at some of the Westminster dogs as well. Sarah, see you next year.
Indeed.
There's nothing average about the beauty and the bodies making their way down the runways here in Manhattan for New York Fashion Week. Beauty isn't about average. It's about an abnormal we may all aspire to. Today we meet a young woman who projects that kind of breathtaking beauty, but she is a working fashion model from Ukraine. Alexandra Kutas is her name, and you can see some of her stunning portfolio on our website. In person, she's quite charming, nothing like the wispy, underfed waifs you see on the runways of New York City this week. She is ambitious and has made it as a working model in a wheelchair. Paralyzed since birth, Alexandra came to New York City all by herself to try and get some attention for herself this week and attention for the many problems back home in Ukraine. She's not normal, but she sure is a natural in front of the camera.
I love to express different emotions, to show a life, to show real life on the photos. And of course, like, I don't know, for me it's the same as a fashion. Fashion is alive. I never fake in the pictures. You know, always if you look at my portfolio, it's always how I really felt at the moment.
Would you say that the photo shoot itself was a different way for you to think about your body, that all of a sudden your body was being appreciated in a way that maybe isn't the case when you're just normally getting around?
You know, I would never say that I was not appreciated or it changed my image of myself. I think all this thing with the disability, honestly, it's more about infrastructure. A lot of things are not accessible, unfortunately, especially in the Ukraine. That's the most difficult thing, not about how people see you, because I honestly never had problems with that.
What do you think the statement would be for disability to be much more generally integrated into fashion and fashion shows? Would it be a fresher statement?
Yes, definitely. And I believe also before it was kind of a stereotype that, you know, if you have a disability, they're probably miserable or you're suffering or you're not happy with your life. But right now, more and more people are out there, more and more people successful in different kind of areas. And I believe fashion, it's something which shows, like, what I hope about that, you know, if I'm the girl from the Ukraine, would be able to make it in the fashion world, especially, you know, in the New York, let's say, and be in magazine, work with the different photographers, then I really want that, you know, every single person who has any kind of disability would think, okay, then what my dream is, I can do it too.
What are the limitations working in Ukraine, and how is it possible to be in Ukraine and also be noticed outside in the general fashion world, I mean, here in New York?
In Ukraine, unfortunately, most of the country is not wheelchair accessible. That's what another thing I've been doing so far. I had a project, I had a team and a project to make ramps on the sidewalks in the city center because we don't have it. You know, you won't see people in wheelchairs on the streets most of the times at all. You know, usually I joke, like, if you've seen someone, it was probably me. And it's a horrible thing because I really want to change it because right now, due to the war situation, we get more and more soldiers who are injured and who gets any kind of disabilities. And they need the city to be ready and for them, you know, to live their life normally after that. I understand how hard it was for me and for my family to, you know, to manage everything and to get around. And I want that for people, you know, next generation. It should be different.
Well, I can see you're so determined. Why are you so determined?
It's just, I believe it could make a change. And I believe that people, especially in my country right now, need such kind of change. We need such kind of image.
Yeah, there aren't many images coming out of Ukraine right now.
Unfortunately, and
war images.
Yeah, but still, there are a lot of so talented people who want to make the change, the things in the world, to show the art. And I was so blessed to work with many amazing photographers in Ukraine. You know, we're going through a tough time right now. But I believe that with the love and with the really hard work and passion, you can change things.
Alexandra, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Alexandra Koutsas is a Ukrainian fashion model and accessibility advocate. All of our talk today of average and the tyrannical fiction it represents for American marketing and design and models of success was motivated by a provocative book that takes on how much we conform with other people's notions of what's normal. Developmental milestones for babies, standardized tests, GPAs, and IQ scores, they all measure us against averages that are all pure nonsense. The book is The End of Average, and reading it, I felt as though the author, Todd Rose, was some long-lost brother. He makes the case that no one is average, and that science proves this again and again. Rose is the director of the Mind, Brain, and Education program at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and he says that as a high school dropout who has since excelled well past what was considered to be his below-average potential, there's just no place for average anymore.
All of our systems of opportunity, you know, education in the workplace, are built around the assumption that there is actually an average person that we can reference ourselves against. And it turns out from the science I'm a part of, it's actually not true. There's literally no such thing as an average person.
There's a couple things to be gained from this insight here. One is that if you think about it, I mean, if you daydream about it, it affects everything. I mean, this is everything. This is how we calculate business models. This is how we calculate, you know, ratings on television. I remember when I was in television, if I got a letter from an individual person loving something I did, I was told that person is crazy, ignore them. But if the raw number of who listened and or watched the show, that was what I was supposed to pay attention to because that was the average. That's what you think is wrong with everything in the way we view human performance.
Right. And so we've intentionally built our entire society around this idea of average and deviation from average. And there is a role for averages and group statistics, and it's anytime what you care about is understanding the whole group, that's perfectly fine, and there's plenty to gain there. The failure comes the second you try to make claims about any one person using these group averages.
You begin your book with a story about what happened at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in the 1950s when the Air Force tried to design average avionic cockpit characteristics so that pilots could operate increasingly sophisticated jets that we're developing. Can you describe what you discovered in that project at Wright-Patterson?
Yeah. So, you know, they were faced with some performance challenges, and they were building more and more jets, right? We went from a very small Air Force to a very large Air Force after World War II. And the design challenge was always the recognition that pilots are different size, and how do you create one cockpit that would accommodate most people? The design philosophy from the military, from all the way back to the Civil War, had been designed for the average-sized person. And so they would take, like, say, 10 dimensions of size, and they would calculate the average for each dimension, and then they would say, okay, now design a cockpit for that. And that almost seems intuitively like the right thing to do.
And engineers and designers were put into that project. I mean, this was their job to do the measurements, to work out the averages, and to figure out the design.
Yep. And then there was this one, I would almost call him a kid, 23-year-old recent graduate named Gilbert Daniels, who was brought in to be the person, you know, with the tape measure, you know, measuring these different pilots on, you know, 100 different dimensions of size. And he harbored this feeling that the idea of average might be the problem. And he persuaded the military chiefs to let him ask a simple question with some data, which was how many of these sort of 4,000 pilots they were measuring were actually average on these 10 dimensions of size. He does the math, and it turns out not a single pilot was actually average on these dimensions of size. So they realized they had created a cockpit that was a bad fit for almost everyone. And to their everlasting credit, the second they figured that out, they actually instituted a mandate that they would never allow cockpits or flight suits or things to be designed on average. And they forced designing to the edges is what we called it.
Well, let me disclose to you, my dad started his career as an industrial designer at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in that precise project.
No way.
Way.
And this is terrific.
And he was working on exactly that. And he would come home, you know, later when I was just a baby then, but he would come home with stories of how scared they were to tell the generals at the Air Force that this whole assumption about average was wrong. But once they got over the hump, everything changed.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? I mean, they deserve so much credit because this was a design philosophy that had been built into military assumptions from the very beginning. And to have a group of people at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base really challenge this basic assumption and convince the powers that be that this was the problem. I mean, we almost lost a war because of bad design. And like, they deserve all the credit in the world for really allowing us to have an incredibly diverse and talented pool of pilots.
And I mean, I've lived this because I'm a disabled person. I'm in a wheelchair. And I discovered that, you know, being weird all of a sudden meant that every time you enter the room, okay, maybe people stare at you, but the system is designed for normal people, which is another word for average. Mm-hmm. And the system shuts down every time someone who's not normal comes up to the desk and says, "Hi, I'm here." And it turns out that means the system has to shut down all the time. And we've seen it in healthcare. We've seen it in industrial processes. What you describe in your book is the complete sort of chaos that's happening as we refuse to recognize this individuality.
Yeah. And I think that what I wanted the readers to appreciate is that this was intentional. You know what I mean? Like, we built a system because we no longer trusted individuals, and we thought it was about just the efficiency of the system, and it meant we didn't care about any one person. But nowadays, we have an economy that can make use of just a wide range of talents, and we need them. And everyone's clamoring for, you know, personalized education, better fit in our jobs, you know, more personal health care. But at the end of the day, if we don't realize that the mindset is the problem, we won't get to these solutions.
Todd Rose is director of the Mind, Brain, and Education Program at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and author of The End of Average. And boy, I want to go to Average's funeral.
Me too.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Within the bloody civil war in Syria and the wider violence in the region, Kurds see a breakdown of a political agreement that deprived them of a nation, a normal nation, a century ago. The 1916 Sykes-Picot Agreement carved up the crumbling Ottoman Empire and gave a nation with borders drawn by European diplomats to Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Armenia, and Palestine, among others. The borders of all those nations are now in flux in the war with ISIS, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, and the Kurds of Syria and Iraq. The Kurds in Iraq today have made a dreamy, peaceful oasis amidst the fighting and are trying to enlarge that territory with gains in Syria and longstanding aspirations for the ancient Kurdish cities of Diyarbakir and Hakkari inside Turkey. This week, Turkey has asked for international help to fight insurgency in Syria, although Turkey has been bombing and besieging the Kurds in Syria, backed by Russia and the U.S., and suppressing its own Kurdish population. The sound there of thousands of Kurds taking to the streets this week in the city of Diyarbakir to commemorate the 17th anniversary of the arrest of Kurdish leader and founder of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, Abdullah Öcalan. The protests come amidst widespread curfews, crackdowns against thousands of academics, and the deaths of over 1,000 people, the majority of which are Kurdish civilians in urban areas. It is a tense time for any Turk or ethnic Kurd to speak out against the government, and access to information out of eastern Turkey has been virtually cut off. Meanwhile, Hisar Ozoy, a Kurdish member of the Turkish parliament with the HDP party, says the government's actions are bringing Turkey to the verge of civil war.
It's a crackdown. It's not a fight against terror. It's a crackdown on Kurdish people who have a very clear demand, which is autonomous self-government. The kind of violence that now we have in the Kurdish region in Turkey is related to, on the one hand, the Kurds' decisive demand regarding autonomous self-government and the Turkish state's very brutal repression of that demand and that political will. Look at some photos from the Kurdish media, because the Turkish media doesn't show anything. There is immense censorship in Turkey. There are tanks everywhere, heavy artillery, constant shelling, destroyed buildings. It is kind of a post-apocalyptic thing there. And of course, if you ask the Turkish state and the prime minister and the president, they will say, oh, we are fighting the terrorists. They don't even accept the term collateral damage. They say no civilians were killed. And they are continuing with this very planned and deliberate massacre. And anybody who is critical of the government's policies is being accused of being a traitor, an enemy, or a terrorist.
Is that what you're being accused of?
Of course. I mean, the government says, actually, that we are terrorists, the president, on a daily basis. It's a very both racist, xenophobic, and dangerous discourse that he's using. So he's really, I mean, he's out of control.
Do you think that President Erdogan sees the developments in Iraq as a wave of change that he wants to get on the other side of and basically create a headwind to prevent Kurdish aspirations from becoming too prevalent?
That was a big fear for the Turkish state and government, that the Kurds in Turkey will somehow follow the model in Iraq. The Turkish establishment, the Turkish ruling bloc, think that within this whole mess in the Middle East, the Kurds are the main national security threat. That is why Turkey is trying to repress the Rojava revolution. What Turkey is doing is actually a counter-revolution. And to prevent the Kurds from achieving that political status, they have been supporting all kinds of fundamentalist jihadist groups with whom the Kurds are fighting, including the ISIS, and it's not working. So here is a larger picture. The Middle East is being reshaped. The kind of political system that was established after the First World War in the Middle East, that system is gone. Iraq, Syria, they are all into pieces. And the Kurds are emerging as a crucial regional actors. We do think that despite all this chaos and crisis that is happening now in the Middle East, there are also certain opportunities. And we want the world to perceive the Kurds also as a factor who can contribute to the stabilization and normalization of politics in the Middle East. There is so much fight among multiple actors, local, regional, global powers. They are all fighting in Syria, but none of them can propose a model that would help people to come together, negotiate their differences, and live in peace, other than the Kurds.
Is it your position that Turkey is also, in eastern Turkey, a battleground of a Turkish civil war that mirrors what's going on in Iraq and Syria?
Yeah, I mean, in Turkey, it is almost a civil war, I should say, because so far it has been between the Turkish state forces and army and the people. But we suspect that if we can't somehow contain this current cycle of violence, it may spread to other parts of Turkey, and then actually we may have a civil war. In fact, one of our main arguments is that Erdogan's rigid and racist policies may turn Turkey into another Syria. And this is a time to wait for a moment and think about how to deal with the Kurdish question, how to ensure internal peace. And the Kurdish conflict is the main source of tension, right? If it goes on like this, if the state continues this war on the Kurdish people, this crackdown, and kills indiscriminately, destroys whole towns, if they continue like this, definitely there will be a civil war.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Hisyar Ozay is a Kurdish member of the Turkish parliament with the HDP party. Let's end our time together by looking once again at this tyrannical idea of average. Gresham, Oregon says, I'd have to say that I am above average. Why? Having a master's degree puts me there. Okay. Also, my wife and I have been married for 36 years and counting. Okay. Our first marriage is two. Okay. Also, my career as an educator, which I love, sets me apart from the masses of folks who hate their work. Okay, Gresham.
Hi, yeah, this is Holly Freeman in Portland, Oregon. I'd say the only thing I'm above average in is in emotional intelligence. I communicate well with people in crisis. In my work with aging folks and adult protective services, it's been crucial to stay focused on needs of the vulnerable people whose family dynamics are not terribly stable. And now I work in a public library where these skills still are very important.
Those righteous people from Oregon, I'm telling you. Let's hear from Dallas. How about above average on intelligence, average on finances, and above average on charm and good looks? Louisville, Kentucky. I am above average. I have an IQ of 142, own all of my homes and cars without debt, and have plenty of money in the bank. Well, hey there, Louisville. Here's one more thing. The average person, I guess, doesn't want to grate their own Parmesan cheese. They want to shake it out of a jar, right, and avoid the unwieldy blocks from Parma. Well, the old cheesemakers from Parma know that you can't put their Reggiano in jars. It will clump up and you can't shake it. The solution to this problem has been to load up Parmesan dust with cellulose, an anti-clumping agent made from wood pulp, or to use cheap cheese substitutes. Either way, it's not the 100% Parmesan cheese consumers are promised. Castle Cheese is in bankruptcy over abuse of this technique. Its president is expected to plead guilty to criminal charges this month for knowingly mislabeling Castle's Parmesan cheese. No fake Parmesan. That's above average. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.